Welcome to the Animation Pimcast, live from Utrecht. Utrecht. Utrecht.
It's hard to make those sounds.
It's the last day of the Holland Animation Festival. What day is it? March 22nd.
March 22nd. That's Sunday, right. March 22nd, yeah. At roughly noon. No, 1 o'clock.
You'll be in the people hearing this will be in the future, months from now. So yes, we're live at the Holland Animation Film Festival, and today's guest is Tom Schroeder, who did the bike ride. Bike ride?
Is it? Bike ride. Bike. Yeah, just bike,
bike ride.
Ride.
Yeah. And then one of my favorite films ever, Marcel King of Tervuren.
Tervuren. Okay. Yeah, I'll keep correcting your pronunciation.
So welcome.
Thank you,
Tom.
Chris.
It was a pleasant surprise to find out that you would be at the festival.
Yeah, and it was a pleasant surprise to run into you, though I kind of imagined you would be here.
Yes, I try to be here as much as I can. You have a film here.
I have a new
film that I haven't seen.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
No.
Isola del Giglio.
And what's the background? Is this one that you
wrote something in support. I was trying to get some money, and you wrote a supporting...
Did you get money?
I didn't get that money, but I got some different money.
Right.
Yeah, I got enough money. Isola del Giglio is just a... It's the story behind that is just that I was at the Cinémathèque Française in Paris at the moment, and it was the 100th anniversary of Jacques Tati's birth, and they were doing a retrospective program of his films, and they rebuilt the house from Mon Oncle, the modern house.
All right.
So they had a big exhibit, and I had seen that just before I went to this little island called Isola del Giglio. Friends have gone there, Italian friends go there every June as a family vacation. And so they took us along, and it immediately put me in mind of the La Plage, the little resort in Les Vacances de Monsieur Hulot. And so I thought it would be an interesting experiment to make a animated tribute, so to speak, to the Jacques Tati style. Yeah. That kind of slightly detached, ever so melancholy, observational, non-narrative, floating, drifting vacation feel.
Right.
And especially given the Italian propensity toward gestural behavior and exaggerated gestural behavior.
So how long were you working on that, and what
that one
techniques did you use too?
Right, that's I had a little sound recorder like the one you're recording us with right now that I took to the island. This was on a second trip back to the island, and I just recorded ambient documentary footage because I like the documentary sound. I think right. Marcel King of Tervuren is obviously a documentary. Bike Ride is a documentary. Working off of audio footage is a great help for someone like me in terms of structuring a film without storyboarding or much pre-production or preconception. You just follow the structure of the sound. You follow the accents in the sound. You follow the beats of the sound. You follow the atmosphere and texture of the sound. And a story, if there is a story. And then I had a sketchbook, so I just observed people, drew caricatures of these people, devised vignettes, sort of gags, and then generated a lot of footage over the course of a year and a half with three people that I hired to help draw, and then structured the film in editing. Showed it in Korea in November to a bunch of animators when I was on a jury at a festival. I sat down and had an uncomfortable experience in a bar with all of them where they kind of hedged and told me they didn't think it was finished, felt despondent. Went back to my hotel room, slept for 2 hours, woke up, started re-editing the film on my laptop, which I had along with me, cut it down from 12 minutes to 10 minutes, and made a new beginning for it that explained some things that were too subtle for people to apprehend.
So they were right, do you think? Or?
I felt that they were right, yes. That it could have usefully been edited from the 12-minute form that it was. I generated about 15 minutes of footage, cut it down to 12 myself, showed it to people who suggested I cut it down further, and it may now even be too long for people because it is a hovering, non-narrative experience. It has thematic development.
Right.
It has a sort of a musical structure of motif and repetition, but it doesn't have a traditional arc, narrative arc. Marcel is a manipulative film, and mm-hmm. that it's got both music and it's got a very strong narrative arc. So a bike ride as well. Those are the kinds of films that people tend to respond to. This is, I think I made a good film, but it's a different sort of drifting film that... is a difficult sell at festivals in programs of 10 tight little intense
right.
Graphic experiences.
Is it common for you to get a lot of feedback for your work?
It didn't used to be because I'm sort of a provincial bumpkin and I functioned in isolation in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You know, the first influence that I actually had contact with was Chris Sullivan, because he was a student at the school that I now teach at, the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. Right. He stayed in Minneapolis for a couple years after that. By the time I came to Minneapolis, he was living there and showing his films around town, so I saw some of his early short films. And in addition to things like Norman McLaren and Brothers Quay, which I was seeing at the same time, I suddenly had this revelation of what was possible in animation, because before I'd seen Bugs Bunny on television growing up, and I saw suddenly this world in which people were expressing states of consciousness and alternative ways of thinking about presenting narrative in films. And someone like Chris, who has both, in his early films, he has this kind of subtle observational documentary sense to his films, but also this subjective intervention and this overflow of stream of consciousness. Right. I was really taken with his films, and he's a super nice, kind individual who was really supportive of me, who has absolutely no background at all in visual art whatsoever, right. No schooling, no propensities, really. My background is in literature, in terms of school. I went to school and studied literature. So Chris was really supportive.
So is that where you stumbled into animation for the first time, really?
I would say it is indeed, yes. It was seeing Chris Sullivan's films and then getting encouragement that one could make films. And I really think...
What were you studying at that time?
I was not studying. I was done with school, and I was playing in a rock band and drinking a lot. Oh, it's Kevin. Do we ignore him or what?
Yeah, we just ignore him.
Okay. just being a confused young person and trying to figure out what I was going to be doing in my life, both in terms of making money and just how one maintained a sort of psychological balance and lived beyond 30, which is what a lot of people in their 20s are doing.
So what was your next step when you decide you'll, I guess, give animation a try?
Yeah, I should say that I always loved film, and I wanted to be a filmmaker at some point. And I applied to UCLA, USC, and I think NYU film schools, graduate schools. And I think I got accepted into one of the programs. But by the time I did, I decided that I'd rather spend the money just making films, and that I didn't have the social skills to make live-action films. And so when I saw Chris making animated films, I thought, this is it. This is a way you can make films if you're a solitary introvert who likes to sit in a windowless room with a light bulb hanging from a string for 12 hours a day listening to Glenn Gould's first recording of the Goldberg Variations and 50s bebop.
So that's what you did?
That's pretty much what I did for 10 years. And, there's another stage before that, too. But I would say that was a glorified state of ignorance and of solitude.
Like someone's looking at me from the window.
they're in their little worlds. They're not even aware that we're here, I think. We could just talk about them. Right. We could speculate about their relationship and about what's going
to... That would be so interesting to the audio listeners.
Okay. see, where was I? Live action, not work, animation. I would say that there was the first state... the glorified state of ignorance, of not imagining that there should be an audience for what one is doing, not really caring, not even knowing that film festivals exist. When I first started experimenting, I had a collaborator who was really just my best friend, who I was playing music with. He was the drummer in the band, and we had Super 8 cameras. I think we saw Street of Crocodiles. He had a barn in western Wisconsin. We both, when I say provincial bumpkin, I'm not exaggerating. We both grew up in little tiny dairy farming towns in Wisconsin. And his father had a barn that we appropriated as our film studio. We built sets, shot mimicry as best we could in black and white of Brothers Quay films. When we could control the lighting at night from dusk till dawn, wore white lab jackets, took notes about what was working, what wasn't, painstakingly went over all of the footage that came back and decided what was the next step. And that was really our kind of little laboratory. I suppose that's film school. We did that for a couple of years, my friend Dave Hare and I. To bring it back to the present, I just would say I'm starting to make a film about him because he died of a brain tumor 5 years ago. Oh. And he was really just my best friend of my adult life, a collaborator in every way, a highly creative individual who was an inspiration. And I'm trying to make a completely comic and unmaudlin film about his death from a horrible, that glioblastoma multiform tumor that's just a death sentence. It basically, you get the tumor, you have a seizure, they discover the tumor, they operate five times, slowly lobotomizing you, put you in intensive care while your muscles atrophy and your loved ones get to see you kind of shrivel and dwindle and the stare in your eyes become more and more vacant, and then you die. Basically, they take you off life support and you die. They pump
you
full of morphine.
I'm
going to make a comic film about this, yes. A comic experimental film in the spirit of youth, of broad experimentation, of process-oriented experimentation in the way that we were. It's just, and using materials that we generated in the barn as the irritant to begin the process, using things that he generated, all these files that I have on a hard drive that I can actually animate with, Photoshop files and his graphic design stuff. So it'll be just taking all these materials and then kind of doing a thematic meditation upon a portrait of him as a person, a reflection back on my life 30 years ago, just the passing of time, you know, all these sorts of things that would potentially be related to that in the way that I just generate footage spontaneously and then try to make a film that might be meaningful to someone out of it.
I imagine it'll be... Okay,
hopefully finding something that creates a state of empathy or an invitation for another person in through the specificity of detail.
Right.
I mean, that's ultimately the goal.
I'm sure it'll be an emotional ride, though, creating
unemotional
yeah. ride.
Well, yeah. I mean, but isn't that kind of the most interesting thing to do? I kind of feel like maybe I don't know how everybody works. I mean, I certainly talk to a lot of people at festivals, talk to filmmakers about what's going on in their lives and how that finds its way into their films. You're kind of an interesting person in that you write about animation, but your life is very much in your writing as well. I mean, you have a funny sort of confessional attitude toward
animation just happens
life.
To be the thing I do.
Right.
It's
sort of like James A. G. writing. I don't know if you've read James A. G.'s film criticism. To me, the films are irrelevant. I mean, his criticism is basically, when I say irritant, those films were just an irritant to ignite some activity in his brain,
right.
And then he tries to exhaust his ingenuity around that irritant,
right.
And creates these little marvels, these little... aesthetic artifacts.
You know, there were some music critics in the 70s, one Richard Meltzer,
who would
review concerts he didn't go to or
yeah.
or review a box set of some jazz musician, and somehow it led back to memories of a first date seeing that performer.
Right.
And it just goes into his own.
But that would be the most interesting thing that anybody could do with their professional activities or their personal activities is try to engage in an examination of what's happening. Where do we come from? Where are we going? How do
right.
I feel? What are my relationships about? Are they good? Are they bad? Am I behaving well? Am I happy? And all those sorts of things.
A bike ride, that wasn't your story, was it?
It was not my story, but in fact it was my story,
right.
Chris. And I'll tell you why. And I'll tell you why it's everybody's story and why that film is successful. Because it is in fact an invitation for people to... people that saw that film say, I had a bike ride. I had that bike ride. I did that bike ride. Because everybody can identify with the experience of being in love with somebody and, you know, kind of exaggerating yourself, presenting and promoting yourself to that person and then having it fail. It's something that everybody can identify with. But it was a student of mine at the time. He came back from his summer break. I said, "What did you do?" He told me that story. I said, "Well, that's a pretty good story."
Yeah.
And I said that I was getting divorced at the time, so it was close
resonated.
To my experience. So my investment in the film of the time, 9 months that I spent every day drawing that, was kind of a cathartic experience of thinking about my divorce and going through that period with the act of making the film. Should be said, too, that I have a schizophrenic brother who was just out of the psychiatric hospital for the first time. I took my grant money that I had for that film, paid him his first job out of the psychiatric hospital to do the inking of the film,
right.
But he was very uncertain. He was on medication, for one, and his hand was shaking and uncertain, so he couldn't do the really fine, defined strokes. So I actually felt like one of the cleverest things that happened with that film was I used his shaky ink line when the character started to lose his confidence in the film. No one has ever actually noticed this or commented about it, but it starts off with a very confident line, and then it evolves into my schizophrenic brother's doubtful, self-doubting, uncertain line. And I thought I used it really well aesthetically. It served a social purpose. It served me helping my brother. And then it actually served an aesthetic purpose in the film. So instinctively, all of those things worked with that. Then you go to festivals with it. I go to Ottawa with it. John Andrews from Kachu at the time finds me, says, hey, you have representation. What is that? We need to go have a drink. You end up making toilet paper commercials with this style that, you know, meant a lot to you, was actually something that maybe saved your life and saved your brother's life or something at the time that you were doing it. And then you take it into the world and it serves this entirely other purpose. And then everybody who's doing this kind of thing has to come to terms with that, both intellectually, morally. And that's the way people make a living.
How did the student feel when he saw it?
It's a good question, because from the time that I recorded it, and I recorded it with less fidelity than this, but informally like this. We were just sitting in a park. I bought him a sandwich. He told the story. And I always thought that I would edit it, take him into a studio, and re-record it. But when I did that, he had become an evangelical Christian in the time that it elapsed, and he didn't want to associate himself with the content. And so he didn't do it. So I had to use this very rough recording, which actually turns out to be pretty good because it's very spontaneous and conversational. And I had to clean up the sound in a studio to get some of the traffic noises out of it, which is why it sounds like it's on a telephone. But he actually was quite unhappy with it by the time it was done, because he'd gone through this conversion and Jesus Christ. He found Jesus Christ.
The breakup had quite an effect on him.
It has to be said, the poor kid came from a really unstable situation. His family was in a lot of disorder, and he's an incredibly bright kid.
You still have any contact with him?
I haven't for a long time now. I've lost track of him.
Might be in a monastery now.
He could be. He could be.
Wow. What year was that film?
I made it in 2000, but because, again, well, you know, this is actually that's right. The film that I started to discover that film festivals existed. I think that was maybe the third or fourth film that I'd finished, and I had a student from Italy who was an exchange student who came to MCAD, which is actually how I ended up on Isola del Giglio, too. And her father had grown up in Annecy, and she'd been at the Annecy Festival from age 7, and all she wanted to ever do was be an animator. I showed Bike Ride in my class just to show what I did, and she said, you made that film? I said, yeah, that's my film. Have you sent that to Annecy? What's Annecy? And she said, it's just the biggest animation festival in the world. I think it would get in. And so I said, oh, okay. And so I sent it to Annecy, and it got in, and then I went, and then I was in a program with Paul Dreesen, and I didn't even really know who Paul Dreesen was, and then I started meeting people, and everybody was, no, there weren't any rock stars, everybody was really accessible and friendly, and Paul Dreesen invited me to come to Paris after the festival, and suddenly I thought, wow, this is actually really cool, that you can put your film into the world, and people ask you for your autograph, like school kids come up and ask you for your autograph, and you meet all these really sympathetic, nice, intelligent, smart people who are doing what you do, and you can sit and talk about it and identify with each other. So then I started to think of film festivals as a social experience, as right. well as meeting the people that, you know, are important in your life.
It's an extended dysfunctional family.
Okay.
All of us.
Rosto is actually probably my best festival friend. We see each other maybe only once every 2 years, and I think that we probably wouldn't like each other if we lived in the same city. We would probably annoy each other to the point that we wouldn't hang out.
Right.
But I think you're going to interview him after this. You tell him I said that, actually, if you feel like it. But when we see each other, we immediately, there's something that just kind of clicks, and we couldn't be different dispositionally.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
But all we do is argue. We have completely contrary points of view about everything, and we do stimulate each other to just defend our points of view so strongly that we actually have to examine what our points of view are about in the process of defending it. And it's really engaging. And then we end up sometimes staying up all night, see the sunrise, and then we weep uncontrollably together. Because beneath all the...
I assume there's alcohol involved?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, there's alcohol involved. But behind all the devil, leather pants, rock and roll attitude, Rasta is actually a very sensitive...
That's what I'm hoping to uncover.
Well, you might have to work kind of hard. But yeah. You might have to make it till the sun comes up.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
But that whole part of the discovering the festival world was a big... things happened in terms of being able to make money, doing some commercials for a period of time, and then maybe getting more access to money to make films as well, just by having a little track record that was impressive to people. Oh, your film was in Annecy. Makes it easier to get money to make films. So once I discovered that, everything became easier, and then I had a conflicted public relationship with, you know, my film started to have a public life a little more, and I'm not incredibly conflicted about it, but I am a person who doesn't like the politics of festival life. I mostly just like to sit and talk to other people.
Right. Well, what do you mean the politics of festival life?
Well, I would say the politics of festival life are, okay, say I want to ingratiate, I want you to be more sympathetic to what I do. I don't think it would make any difference if I were sitting talking to you and we liked each other as to how you would select a film. But I think there is a politics about how people attend festivals to create a presence for themselves that makes it more likely that their films are going to be selected. Or how do films get selected? It's getting harder, isn't it? Because people are making so many fucking films that you guys have to watch. How do you possibly watch all those films? I was talking to Emma de Swaff and Mark Rules in Ghent a couple weeks ago, and they said that, I think you missed Oh Willie the first time around, right?
Yeah.
So that happens, because that's a kind of slow film. You might watch 2 minutes of it and go, not sure this is going anywhere.
I didn't even see it.
You didn't even see it.
It slipped through the cracks somehow.
So it was just actually a mistake.
Yeah.
But I was talking to Karin from Anima, and she said she has missed films, that she had maybe the first chance to show it at a festival, watched it, wasn't sure, let it go, saw it a year later at another festival, and suddenly said, what was I thinking? It was just the state of mind in which she saw it, because she was exhausted and completely fatigued from seeing so many films.
That used to bother me when that would happen, but now it's...
Yeah. I mean, what can you do? The good stuff is ultimately going to make it through somehow and get seen. But that's what I mean by politics. It's just like the personal... I mean, because there's it's a small world. There's a certain number of people who have a degree of power in terms of making visibility for things. And then, you know, that's always a part of personal politics, of people trying to ingratiate and manipulate and motivate and make things happen for themselves.
Yeah, I think I talked to somebody about that a few years ago. When I sort of took over in Ottawa, traveling festivals... You start having maybe more acquaintances or friendships than you've ever had in your life, and I started reached a point where I wondered how many of these people would really be my friends if I wasn't, you know, is it because they think they can get into Ottawa if they're, so you start doubting as
right.
well, but
I mean, I think you would know who your friends are, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty, at this point, 25
Kevin
years
is probably
later,
your friend, right?
Yeah, if we were out of animation, we'd still be friends. So. But Bike Ride was interesting because you see, today, you see all sorts of films like this. It's using this kind of original documentary audio.
It's happening more? Because, I think I got the idea from Aardman Films. It's been happening for a long time. And,
You
know, like there was Hubley Films in the 70s where they did it. Some of the coolest films from, like, documentary sound. Something About the Merry-Go-Round. It's a crazy film.
Yeah, and Creature Comforts for sure.
Yeah.
But it was something you'd see every once in a while.
Right.
But I think since, I wonder how much influence Bike Ride had on people, because I see it all the time now. That sort of...
I can't speak to that. I don't know. I mean, it was the first of my films that got shown a lot, and it did get shown. I think ResFest at that time was one of those things that created a lot of interest in a film, and they had a magazine, Res Magazine, maybe that still exists.
Yeah.
But it was the first film of mine that got into Sundance. When you're in Sundance, then suddenly there's a lot of people that are interested in showing it elsewhere. You don't even have to really do much work after that because everyone's soliciting it. So it did get around a lot, but I don't know. Every once in a while I see something and I think, maybe they saw a Bike Ride, but not many people contact me.
So. And how many films had you made before that?
Well, if you exclude the experiments in the barn... That was probably my third film, and 16mm film. Yeah, I was still shooting on film. That was the last film that I made on film, per se, that I made on paper. I printed other films to 35 after that, but it was all computer-based process after that. So that was the last organic, fully analog film.
And when did you start, what was the area like in Minneapolis for... animation.
Oh, there's nothing. I mean, there was Chris Sullivan.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say there was nothing. You know, there was one woman named Allison Morse who came to town. Do you know who she is?
I know that name, yeah.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
She was sensible enough to stop, and she became a writer. and now she's writing novels. But she still lives in Minneapolis, most of the time. And there was Chris Sullivan, and then there was commercial animation. There was a place... Actually, there were some really great characters. There was Gavrilo Gnadovich. I don't know if you remember a film called Lazar. It was looked like Pink Floyd, The Wall, that animation, and it was about a guy trying to get outside of a walled city, and there was a judge with the curled wig. he was somebody that was in Minneapolis, and he had a, it was all commercial animation, though. But Gob would occasionally make a film of his own. And it was, I was lucky because in those days, you didn't need any kind of credibility, or you didn't need school. You just walked into these places and said, I'm kind of interested in animation, can I work? And they would just put you to work doing the most menial jobs possible, assembly line work. And then if you were somewhat pleasant to be around, and you showed up every day and you committed yourself to getting better and working hard, then they gave you other tasks. So you
worked it?
Yeah, I worked for Gavril Loganadovich. I worked at a place called RealWorks, which was a commercial house in Minneapolis. So that was the kind of stuff that was happening. And that
when
was,
would that have been?
This would have been late 80s, early 90s.
Wow.
And that's when I would have, my first film would have been made in the early 90s. And those films, you know, those films would show at festivals like, I just knew about a few experimental festivals from Chris, like Ann Arbor. I would send my films to Ann Arbor and they would show there. But they didn't really show anywhere. I mean, there was a distributor in Chicago that put one of them on a VHS collection. I can't even remember the name of the distributor now. But
Facets?
It turned into Facets. Facets grabbed them, but it was something before Facets. It was just an individual, and he loved experimental film. It came out of that Canyon cinema aesthetic of the 60s in San Francisco. He was one of those guys transplanted to Chicago. So it was more of like a kind of hippie cooperative sensibility.
And how has it changed at all in Minneapolis? Is there?
Yeah, I mean, there's Caleb Wood. Caleb Wood is a little bit north of Minneapolis. And then I think that the success of the animation program at MCAD has developed a lot in the last decade. We have good people teaching. We have a person who worked at Will Vinton doing stop motion. We have a good 3D guy. I'm the resident kind of independent, eccentric character.
Right. The Chris Sullivan.
I'm the Chris Sullivan, right? I don't wear pajamas to class, though, or lingerie. And then there is a guy from CalArts who does the character, like the hardcore Disney fundamental character animation. So the school has produced a lot of good people who are animating at Disney and out in L.A. There's a lot of students who've gone into studio stuff, but there's a few that have lingered in Minneapolis. I'm thinking of this girl Michelle Brost, who's making cool films, Emily Fritzy. There's some people that have lingered in Minneapolis who have a more experimental, independent sensibility, who are just starting to make their own short films.
When did the animation, the program start up?
Well, when Chris was there back in the early 80s, there wasn't really an animation program. You could kind of create an animation tract for yourself within the film program, which is what Chris did, but it wasn't until maybe late 90s, 2000, that there was an animation program that had, you know, a distribution of classes that you needed to graduate within that major. It was actually a meaningful program.
When did you start teaching?
I started teaching was what they call adjunct faculty, maybe in the late 90s, and then 2003 I have the position that I have now, which is a sort of quasi, not quite full-time. Full-time enough to get benefits, but not full-time enough to
not
have
quite
to go
tenure?
To, there is no tenure there, but don't have to go to all the meetings, don't have too much responsibility, so I can still get things done. And now I've got this great situation that I've sort of navigated for myself, where I teach three classes in the fall and one class online in the winter. So this winter I've been in Ghent, where Hilda's from. And that's nice because I can teach this class online and be anywhere in the world, so I can do other interesting things if I have opportunities.
And you spend time over here, like in Belgium, Holland area?
Yes. Hilda, my wife, is the story of that is the bike race film. That's the second. You know, there's going to be a trilogy, Chris, that will amount to a half-hour, three-film package.
That you can put together as a feature film?
It won't be as long as Don Hertzfeldt's thing, but it'll be a half an hour. It'll be a television half hour, a Simpsons episode. But the second film of that, they're all the common elements are bicycle related unrequited love stories, graphic white line on black field, simple animation style, the drummer Dave King, jazz drummer, improvisation to the vocal track. Those three elements, those are the common things. I have the sound for the third bike film recorded, but I have this sort of obsessive compulsive idea in my head that I only make one every 10 years, so it has to wait till 2020.
You made the second one?
I made the second one, yeah. You didn't show it. I thought that was going to be... It's my favorite film of mine. I remember I showed it to Malcolm Turner. Malcolm Turner did show it. They didn't show it at Annecy either. So to me, it's great, but it could be so personal that the storytelling in it is the most sophisticated that I've been capable of, in that it's there's a lot of complex thematic relationships between nationalism, between male competitiveness, and this love triangle that's at the center of the film. But that one was 2010, mm-hmm. right? So 2010, and there'll be one in 2020. You'll still have a chance to show the trilogy.
Right. What's the appeal of the bike stories?
Obsessive compulsive disorder. I mean, it's just like getting fixated on an idea. But, I mean, it's because the bike film was sort of the first thing that worked for me. Honestly, the films I made before that aren't very good. And some of the films I made after that aren't so good. I've made some films that I think are good that were a little bit neglected. I'm not sure why. But Bike Ride was the first film that I made that was kind of good.
We showed another one. You did
Yellow Bird, right? 2008. Yeah. I think that's a good film. Yeah, that's a grim film. Yeah. That's the kind of film that makes people not want to have a drink with you at film festivals. When you walk out of the theater, people don't make eye contact with you and say, that was great. They kind of just see you and say, oh, that's the guy that made the Yellow Bird film, and go talk to Denis Tupakov.
Yeah. Looking up. Although his films are quite...
the year that it was there was when Chainsaw was there. That's why I think of it, yeah.
Right.
It's a pretty dark film.
Do you get tempted to want to... Well, when you met John Andrews, so that led to some commercial work you did?
Sure. You know, the funny thing, too, about the bike thing is that John Andrews suggested, when he saw Bike Ride, he said, we should develop this into either a series or a feature. Right. And I was like, you can do a feature with this style? And I probably sank it from going anywhere just because I was so skeptical that it could sustain, visually, that it could sustain that kind of length. But the whole idea of doing a episodic thing with documentary audio footage in that style, that kind of free-flowing, Norman McLaren inspired, frankly, you know, like that kind of transformative line style comes from watching Norman McLaren films. That would have been good, and if I were more shrewd and ambitious, I maybe could have developed something at Klasky Csupo with that, because he was interested, but I didn't. But what I did do at Klasky Csupo, at that great period when Igor Kovalyov had Royal Patronage.
The greatest job in the world, yeah.
Basically. It was cool because I got to go into the studio to do post-production on these commercials, and I'd see Igor in the corner with his enclave of sort of secretive Russian animators.
Right.
And he had the full resources of the studio to basically be generating footage, have it printed to 35mm film, look at it in the theater, in the big studio on Hollywood Boulevard, decide to change some things, book time in the sound recording studio. I mean, he basically had major studio resources to make those really completely brilliant but idiosyncratic and individual films that he was making. Milk, I believe, was the last one that he made at Klasky Csupo.
Yeah, and now he's back in, I think he's in Kiev or Moscow.
Is he really? Okay, because I know I had a student at MCAD who, Igor was his mentor at CalArts in the experimental master's program.
Right.
And so I knew he was still out there for a while anyway. But that was...
Yeah, I think he taught a couple of years at CalArts, and then that didn't work out.
Yeah.
Politics, I guess.
Not really. But that period of time was terrifying for me because I have no kind of training, and I'm in awe of these people that have this kind of graphic sensibility, because I'm not, frankly, all that astute visually. I mean, I watch a lot of films. I know film language, but I'm not that creative and inventive in the way that a lot of animators are in terms of that way of thinking. So I felt pretty terrified, inadequate, and I felt like an imposter. And I basically just had to get over that and realize, well, once I got out there, I realized, well, wait a minute, these people aren't actually all that smart.
And everybody's thinking the same thing.
Right, everybody else is just kind of faking it and going through the motions to get paid. And it was, at that time, I think it might have been the last moment for people like me. There's probably some people like me that are still making money, but I made just like this extraordinary, for me, an extraordinary amount of money really fast, and I thought, wow, this is great. At the same time, it was really hard to do it, because not only were you terrified, but the art directors and the agencies were often, I think, quite psychopathic. They didn't feel satisfied. I don't want to, just in general, slander the the trade, but there was a general sense that they weren't completely satisfied until you were weeping uncontrollably on the telephone, until your physical and mental health had broken down. And then they knew that they'd gotten everything out of you that they were paying for. And it was a pretty exhausting experience to go through.
Yeah, it must have been like, I mean, a culture shock in a sense. You go from just making your own.
Yeah, and it's also, you're the kid that made that bike ride film. You're money, dude.
Right.
Did you say that I was money? I'm from the Midwest. I'm money? What does that actually mean? That means I'm good. So, I mean, it's literally, I'm a bumpkin, and I'm in L.A., and there's these people telling me that I'm money. And so it's completely, I'm skeptical of it, basically. I'm skeptical of it all. But you're also making money, and you're meeting people. I met great people, too. I developed a real respect for the funny little village life of L.A., of these enclaves of mostly European immigrants who are working on the periphery of the film industry, right, who are completely brilliant and have great parties, dinner parties, where you're having the best conversations of your life, and you're also exposed to a lot of ideas. And there's a guy named Paul de Meyer, who's a Belgian, right, who was out there, and we became really friendly with him. So there was a lot of good things that came out of it. And then I lost my hipness, or they'd exhausted my stylistic possibilities, and then it's been, I think it's been 5 years since I've done a commercial now.
Did you move to L.A. for a period?
No.
Or?
No, just, no, and that was the great thing, is you're earning L.A. money but living in Minneapolis.
Yeah. Nice.
That was the great moment when the internet was making all of this possible too, you know, where you don't have to be somewhere else.
Yeah.
You can make a commercial from anywhere, from Calgary, if you're Amanda Forbes and Wendy Tilby.
Right.
And you might just have to go for a post-production session where they give you sushi and bagels and orange juice, and you make a decision about a shade of green, and then you fly home.
And then you fly home, yeah, on someone else's
right, exactly,
dime. So let's jump ahead to Marcel.
Ah, yeah.
And to talk about how that whole...
Okay.
I mean, I know the background of it, but...
Right, yeah. Marcel is a function of having married Tilde, my wife, a Belgian, and getting to know her friends and starting to hang out with her friends. Marcel was in fact, because he's dead now, he was the rooster of Anne Bergmoos, who is one of Hilde's oldest friends and became one of my good friends. So every time we'd visit Tervuren, which is on the outskirts of Brussels, we'd sit and drink mostly Chimay Blue, which is the blue label Chimay. It's the middle one. It's the double, the dark Chimay Trappist beer. And she would tell us the latest installment while chain-smoking of what's been happening with her rooster, punctuating it with that great cuckoo-loo-da-coo,
right,
that she does in her kind of husky sort of...
Smoker voice.
Smoker, drinker, big liver. She's someone who has enormous appetites for food and,
right,
and life in general. So she had that kind of vitality, and there was, a lot of it was the quality of her voice, too, that was attractive about it. But as maybe you pointed out, the Sophocles connection, which I hadn't thought specifically, there was a point at which, when Marcel was blinded by his son, that I did think, wow, this is taking on sort of other literary levels,
right,
of interest and could be a good story. It's the kind of thing that I'm interested in terms of the banality of the circumstances. You go through the banality and specificity of local details to arrive at something universal and hopefully affecting in a broader and larger human sense, meaning like people have interpreted that film in outlandish ways, which is great.
What's the most outlandish?
The most outlandish one, which I read in Dutch after the Anima Festival last year, was someone saying Marcel was purposely created with the colors of the Belgian flag, which is also, it's true, but it was inadvertent. And it is an allegory about the divisiveness of the French-Dutch language in the Wallon and Flemish,
wow,
division, the political divisions that caused them not to have a government for 18 months.
That's quite a reading.
I know, but that's great. And that's the great thing about the, when you have something that's as simple and open as that, it allows people to project all kinds of ideological intent into it. And that's, you know, even if you didn't have that intent, it's nice that you've made this framework that allows people to think that way about it. I prefer to think of it in more existential terms. It's just sort of like trouble.
Yeah.
Trouble in the broad sense. I mean, for me, my dad died when suddenly in his sleep of a heart attack at age 20. I got dumped. My wife dumped me to get involved with a woman when we were both 30. my brother suddenly manifested schizophrenia when I was about 35. Friend dies of a brain tumor. Every 5 to 10 years, there's some kind of catastrophic event in your life that forces you to see. It's almost like 19th century Russian fatalism. It's like the Dostoevsky, where the only value in life is a kind of stoic endurance.
Right.
And maintaining management as opposed to evolution or progress, where you just can't see life as progress. You just see life as management. And so Marcel, for me, is, you know, it's kind of like, okay, I'll put it in these terms, and this is like a broad statement about all of my films and philosophy in general. The Walker Art Center, it's a museum in Minneapolis, they put together a program of my films, and they called it Transformative Journeys without consulting me, which couldn't be further from my intent. It's the exact opposite of my intent, because my films are, I would say, an attack upon the Follow Your Bliss, Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces, Hero's Journey, which has become the model since Star Wars for the kind of 18 to 25-year-old manipulation of the male hero wish fulfillment fantasy that most pop culture films are, or most pop culture action films are. Those films, which I loved and still love, actually, Star Wars, didn't prepare me for life. They didn't prepare me for anything. And you start to realize how inadequately you've been prepared for everything. Right. Like nothing prepares you for the horror and devastation and failure of expectations that you're going through constantly. So I started to see my films as an anti-heroic. I mean, it's really the untransformative anti-hero's journey, where there is no transformative experience. There's just survival. And there is a kind of, I suppose, self-deprecating detachment. That's a value. If you can maintain a sense of humor about it and a slight sense of detachment from your experiences, then you've succeeded. And I think that the narrator in Bike Ride, there's something about the self-deprecation in his telling of that story that I find really appealing.
There's a Canadian poet who had a great line I always try to keep close by. I think that the key to finding some kind of peace in life was to accept the absurdity of your own existence.
Right. Well, that sounds like mid-century French existentialism. Yeah. And really, that's what it comes down to. That's what Marcel is for me. But it's kind of the definition of character isn't having fulfilled the hero's journey. It's having failed and been faced with your inadequacy and the failure of your expectations. And then that's what character is. Is like, how do you respond to that experience? That's personally what I would see as an ongoing theme throughout my films.
Did you know? Did you have the ending planned from the beginning?
Of Marcel?
Yeah, I mean, there's just this.
What's the ending?
A subtle picture of the fox.
Oh yeah. No, that's actually a really good question. It turned out to be a good ending. After the point that I recorded on telling the story, Marcel was killed by a fox. And I didn't think he should actually be killed in the film. But I thought the fox should make an appearance at the end. Just as a little tale for An to say, well, here's the fox that came and killed Marcel ultimately. But in the case of the film, it actually is it's a good thing because it creates, again, another cycle
it's
of
like
trouble.
It just never ends.
Right. Yeah. It's just like you think like the credits have rolled and there's more trouble coming.
You just overcame this litany of shit and now
the film is going to go on. Yeah. There's going to be another film. Right. But he actually did get killed by a fox. So it's a kind of the truth of the story is thrown in at the end. But it turned out to be more of a cyclical device of more trouble coming. But it wasn't planned. It wasn't planned until I'd had the film mostly animated.
And how do you feel about the film? I mean, that's probably your biggest success since Bike.
Since, for sure. Those are the only two films that people really pay. I mean, I've had a lot of films at Sundance now, and so in the live-action world, people maybe pay more attention to me than in the animation world. And that's probably because of my sensibility, which is more one literary and one documentary, two documentary, and three maybe with a sense of live-action film language as opposed to graphic sensibility, which is there's some just. The thing that amazes me about animation is the graphic inventiveness and the reinvention of film language and the ability to tell stories in completely unconventional, unorthodox ways, individual, unique, solitary stream of consciousness ways, condensation of consciousness. But if I look at Marcel, I mean, to me, it's, you know, when I finished Marcel, I showed it to An Berkmus, I just came back from the Italian island with my materials for the next film, and I'd finished Marcel, and I showed it to her on a laptop. She looked at it and said, "Hey, Tom, I think you did a good job with the story, but do you think anybody's going to be interested in this film about a rooster, about my rooster?" I was like, "That's a good question. Probably not. I mean, I don't really know. I'll just send it out to festivals and see what happens." And then I actually was pretty surprised by the fact that it was, people were as interested in it as they were, that you were as interested in
it
as you were.
I actually saw it here.
Right, yeah.
2 years ago.
And I wasn't here. Yeah. But if I see it now, if I see a film like 3 or 4 years after I made it, I have a pretty clear sense of how it worked. And it's usually this combination of elements that come together and either work or kind of don't work. Bike ride, the elements as I described were the drum, the story, my animation style. Those things worked really well together. I think we were a jazz group. I see us as a jazz group. And it is improvisation. Those films, none of my films are storyboarded. It is all just straight ahead, kind of making it up as go along and then kind of structuring it after the fact. So it is improvisational as well. So Marcel is another film where the elements kind of worked together. And they are the same elements. It's like maybe that's the film I should be making. And I don't want to make that film every time, but it's a film that has like this 6 minutes long documentary story that people can identify with, that's open enough to be interpreted allegorically in a number of different directions, but also appeals to a kind of universal sense of human need and struggle, with a kind of strong visual style with metamorphosis, Norman McLaren-inspired metamorphosis, and a musical track, a manipulative musical track.
You've got it all figured out.
Well, I've got the recipe figured out for a film that will be popular, which isn't always the film that one wants to make. I'm not too concerned about being popular. In fact, the more popular you are, the more trouble you have in some ways, the more distracted you are from actually just making films.
Right.
It gets you into a realm where you're doing stuff like this where instead of making films.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
That's a perfect
place to
to stop. I actually liked when I think I saw you do this with Chris Sullivan and Chris Landreth the last time I was in Ottawa, and I think it's a really good idea. I really learned a lot about them and hearing them talk about their backgrounds.
Well, it's good when you have people who can talk too. Like
that's true.
Sullivan.
Those guys are both really articulate. Yeah.
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 So, as are you.
Well, thank you, Chris. As are you.
So good luck. Stay strong. Hopefully there's no more. I can't believe the stuff that's happened to you, because I had cancer, my best friend died, divorce, all in a
you the same
short
thing,
period.
Yeah. I mean, the thing to me is there's some people that live these surprisingly placid lives where it's not so eventful and not so much happens.
Right.
But the majority of people I know go through these regular cycles of tragedy and horror and recovery. And it could be self-inflicted, it could be self-destructive things, it could be just, arbitrary deaths and disease and mental illness. A lot of mental illness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
You just
good
go
stuff.
On.
Yep. Confront people with it. And that's the thing about it, I'll just say in closing, animation has this sort of reputation, or at least it did when I was young, of being a kind of escape, right? Escapist entertainment, where you didn't have to worry about the brain tumor. It was the way that you didn't think about the brain tumor. The cat chased the mouse, and there were gags for 7 minutes, and it was sort of a release of tension. But I think that after the 70s, certainly, there was that whole other, and it was happening before that, of course, as well, but there became a huge movement that was then really released when the digital means of production came about, where people were just telling the hard, good stuff.
I was thinking, like, last year in Ottawa, we had SWAF, which is about alcoholism, Nuggets, Andrea Cicada, about addiction.
That's here now, isn't it?
Yeah. Through the Hawthorne, about mental illness.
I've seen that film. That's
suddenly
good.
You see more and more of these films dealing with...
Well, that year that Chainsaw was, and my film The Yellow Bird was at Ottawa, that was a really dark year.
Yeah.
Everybody was saying it was due to the economic collapse or something, but it was a particularly apocalyptic
selection. Or I had a bad
selection.
Year.
Or maybe your selection was skewed in a certain direction, yeah. But, okay, so that's probably enough.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Yeah, it was fun.